Glad to be with you tonight. Glad that you're here. I am somewhat surprised to see Jeff here tonight. He was supposed to be in Austin, which is why I'm up here tonight. Needless to say, if you're here, I'm not the normal preacher. If you're visiting with us, Jeff's the normal preacher. We're glad to have you with us tonight. If you're visiting with us and you're not part of God's kingdom, I learned a term several years ago about being a seeker. And we're glad that you're here. We're glad that you're seeking something in your life, that you're seeking, hopefully, God. Unfortunately, tonight is not necessarily a lesson for you. I'm going to be speaking primarily to those that are a member of God's kingdom. I am going to be talking about some things that if you and I were talking privately, I would certainly not talk about. But in this place at this time, I feel it's important to talk about some things about how Christians, some supposed Christians and others that actually are Christians, express their beliefs in today's world. So I would ask your apologies for that. And we'll come back to you in a little while talking about some things. But for now, we're going to be talking about some things that I see in the world of how Christians represent themselves and how I think they're doing more damage sometimes to God's cause than they are helping. I want to thank the elders for the opportunity to talk tonight. Can't go without saying that. And again, finally, if you have any issues with something I talk about tonight, I'm going to step on some toes, including my own, tonight and in the past. I asked you that you would come talk to me, come find me. My goal is to always present God's truth, and don't necessarily always do that, so you'll be doing me a favor if you come and talk to me about those things. One of the things that we deal with in the world today is how do we engage those of the world in our everyday lives? Paul here is writing to Christians in Corinth, and his specific instruction was to disengage with those that are immoral, but specifically with those that are immoral of the church. If you're reading the verse, he very explicitly says we cannot remove ourselves from the immoral of the world, else how can we influence them? How can we educate them? How can we expose them to Christ? Let me dispel a couple of myths before we get started, before we delve any further. First of all, there's a belief out there, and I've heard it, many people talk about it, that today's world is the most immoral that we've ever been around. The United States is immoral. The United States has lost its moral compass, those are all true statements. If you compare today's world versus what I grew up in, there's a lot of things that are a lot more prevalent and a lot more public than they were 40, 50 years ago. However, I don't believe today's world is as bad as it's ever been. Time of Noah, the world was so evil that God said, I regret making man. He doesn't tell us what the evil is necessarily, but it was evil. So he destroys the world with a flood, starts over with Noah and his family, and we end up where we are today. A few years later, we come to Abraham and Lot. Lot chose to live in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah instead of out in the country where Abraham was. And while God was deciding what he wanted to do with Sodom and Gomorrah, he sends a couple of angels in to visit the city. They come into Lot's house, And the men of Sodom and Gomorrah, seeing these two strangers in the town and in Lot's house, go surround it. And the verse says, the young and the old alike go and surround Lot's house and ask Lot to send the men out so that they could know him, them. And I put to you that getting to know them was not a social where they go around and share stories. It was sexual immorality, homosexual activity that these people of Sodom and Gomorrah were interested in engaging in. If we move ahead a few more years, Israel's gone into Egypt. They've come out of Egypt. They've done the 40 years in the wandering in the wilderness. They've spent 350 years conquering Judah, dealing with the natives of Canaan, gone through the periods of the judges where God has gone, I think it's 13 times, correct me on the number, different judges, different times where they had fallen away from his teachings. God punished them, sends a judge to correct them. They turn around and recognize God as God who he is. They turn around again. Well, in Judges 21:25, he says, every man did evil in his heart. Man had turned away from God, had forgotten all that he had done, and did whatever he felt was right. Kind of sort of back like in the days of Moses, Noah again. So the world really isn't any more immoral today than it was in the Old Testament times. If we go to New Testament times, I could sit up here and talk to you for hours about first century. Let's talk about just the city of Corinth. The city of Corinth was a port city. If you know anything about port cities, even in today's world, sailors get into all sorts of troubles in port cities. They had the same opportunity in Corinth that they have today. Corinth was known for its immoral lifestyle activities that were there. They've done dredging under the bays that are around Corinth, and they find alcohol containers by the dozens. Illicit activity, the drugs of the day were there. Sexual immorality was there. The first century Greeks and Romans had a term that was said that was meant to be to do the Corinthian, and that was not a compliment. If you were told that you were acting like a Corinthian, that was very, very debased behavior. And finally, Jesus was sent to a world that, if we look at all the details, would not be that much different from today. Yeah, they didn't have TV. They didn't have the internet. But they had sexual immorality. They had temple prostitutes that was their lifestyle was to give up their body in the temples of all these gods that they had around. They had drugs. They had alcohol. The Old Testament's full of warnings about watching for strong drink. The government was corrupt. We're going to talk about that more in a second. But the world that Jesus was in really wasn't any different than the world today. The ways that things are communicated are different, but the message, the communication, the things that were talked about, the things that were done really aren't any different than what we have today. We expect the government to fix things. I fully understand the verses in the Bible that tell us to pray for our leaders, to pray for peace, and I do all of that. But if we're going to expect the government of the United States or the government of Nicaragua or the government of England or whatever country you want to pick, to come and fix the immoral activities of this or any other country, it's not going to happen. So if we're expecting Congress and the president of this country to outlaw pornography, to outlaw homosexuality, to outlaw homosexual marriages, strong drink, we tried that once, it wasn't very successful. It's not going to happen. So we've just got to deal with that and move on with what we're going to be doing in our lives. Again, Christ came into a world that the government persecuted Christians, sponsored activities, crucifixion, that they paid taxes for. Christ told them to pay unto Caesar what was Caesar's, pay unto God what is God's. So they were expected to interact with the government and accept what was going on and still be a Christian in their lives. Again, the Roman Empire, if you ever look at history, Roman Empire was as debased a government, as debased a society as ever been around, shy of the Canaanites in Israel when they kicked them out with their sacrificing children as they did their activities. And finally, there are some that think that we're not supposed to interact with the world, that we're supposed to withdraw ourselves, not interact with them, not be tempted by them. But in reality, is that really what we're supposed to do? How are we going to evangelize? Are we just going to evangelize those that do come in the door seeking? Are we just going to evangelize those at work? Or are we truly going to seek those who need to know God, who may have an interest of knowing God? 50 years ago, I've heard, wasn't cognizant at that point in time, a huge percentage of this country, the population of this country, knew the Bible. They had grown up on it, reading it, at least being exposed to it. So 50 years ago, when you had a gospel revival, you'd have 400 or 500 people come in and you'd have hundreds of conversions. Today's society is not like that. Today's society, the average person on the street has probably never read a Bible, may not have ever heard someone talk about Jesus. So it's up to us to engage those people, to be able to build a relationship with people that will allow them to do that if they wish to. And if we're only going to focus on those that we think want to be Christians or who are good enough to be Christians, are we really going to those people who really need God and Jesus in their lives the worst? Hence the term seekers in those that are looking to improve their lives. Finally, there's a concept that I've heard before that Jesus spent a lot of his time and the apostles spent a lot of their time telling people that they were wrong, that they were sinning, that they were going to go to hell, that they were looking for eternal damnation. And I challenge you that Jesus reserved this language only for the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I find nothing in my readings of the gospel where Jesus ever went to the Samaritans or other non-Jews that he met and did nothing but talk to them about their sins. And he certainly didn't ignore it, but that's not his approach, and we're going to talk about two of those here in a second. Paul, if we look at things, well, here's Jesus here in Matthew chapter 7, talking to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, talking to those who claim to know him, basically said, you can claim all you want, but if you don't do what I say, you're going to have eternal damnation. To those that should have known better, should have known what he was talking about. Again, Paul reserved that language to those of the kingdom. 1 Corinthians, we've already looked at this one. Talking to Christians in Corinth. I don't know whether you realize it, but the New Testament primarily was written to Christians. The Gospels were written to a multitude of people, some to Jews, some to non-Jews, Gentiles. Luke wrote his to Theophilus, and we don't know a lot about Theophilus other than he was probably a Gentile. The book of Acts was written to us so that we would know about the spread of the gospel, what they did to spread the gospel, first to Judah, then to Samaria, then to the rest of the world. And everything else in the New Testament was written to Christians. Every letter was written to the saints at or somewhere. So that was all written to those that had accepted Jesus, supposedly understood the teachings, and Paul or the other writers were primarily correcting things that they were still doing wrong in their lives. So none of the Bible was really written to the Gentiles to teach them what was necessary if they read it. Now, you can certainly get that out of there. I don't want to mislead you or misrepresent things. But the Bible was, New Testament was primarily written to Christians that had already been taught about Jesus. And Paul spends his time in Acts talking to unbelievers, but in the rest of the letters, he's talking to Christians with his life. So, some examples. I suspect most of you have heard about Westboro Baptist Church. I looked long and hard for a picture that I was willing to put up here in front of you. This is a protest that they were having after some Christian killed an abortion doctor. They have also been protesting military funerals, of all things, because they didn't like the government's policy on don't ask, don't tell for the military. So they started protesting the military, and I could not find a single picture I would be willing to put up here because of the language that was in the signs that they had. But they are supposedly representing Christ in going out and protesting these things. Do you think that anybody that doesn't know about Jesus really wants to go and talk to someone from Westboro Baptist Church? I put to you, probably not. There's been a lot of news recently about Christian business owners who did not want to participate in commerce to certain communities. Christian baker that didn't want to sell a cake to a homosexual couple getting married. Photographer didn't want to take pictures of that marriage. Teachers, parents getting upset when teachers are homosexuals in their children's classrooms. And publicly demonstrating about all that. Do we really feel the same way if you want to take that position about someone getting married for the second time without scriptural reason? If you're a baker, are you going to refuse to sell a cake to a couple that's someone's getting married for the second time when they just didn't like their first marriage? How far are you going to take it if you're going to be consistent? Talking about our teachers. My children had a teacher in middle school that was a druggie. Known druggie. Not sure why he was still teaching. Nobody really seemed to care about that. We don't really care about the teacher who is on their third or fourth or fifth marriage. Or the teacher that might be living with their boyfriend, girlfriend out of marriage. But they're still teaching there. But you don't see Christians protesting those behaviors, but they're going to protest homosexuality. Again, I don't believe homosexuality is right, but how are we approaching it? Finally, Christopher Hitchens, if you know the name, was an avowed atheist, wrote many, 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 many articles about there is no God. I don't know how many years ago it was, but he contracted cancer and was dying. And he wrote a couple of articles about the vitriol that he got from Christians saying, you're getting what you deserve. You're paying the price of you being an atheist. You're getting what you deserve. And I've heard lots of others. I mean, people, Hitler got what he deserved. Fill in the blank, you get what they deserve. Is that really how we want to approach someone in that time of their life, when maybe they have an inkling there of maybe there's something more out here than maybe there is a God. But we're going to write them a letter saying, you evil, vile thing, how dare you be an atheist? I hope you die tomorrow. That's what Christopher Hitchens, that's what others have put up with. So, Already talked about that. Feeling elation for those around us. Attacking activities or beliefs that we don't necessarily agree in. I did not go through the parking lot before I was prepping this lesson, so I do not know what you have on your bumpers out there. So let's talk about Planned Parenthood for a second. Do not agree with Planned Parenthood. Think they are leading people wrong, supporting abortions. If I were to go out there and stand on the sidewalk in front of the Planned Parenthood clinic up there at Kirkendall and Louetta, holding this sign up says, abortion is murder. If you kill your baby, you're going to hell. Do you think that one of those young ladies who's in this stressful time of their life is going to be one to come up and talk to me about what's going on? There's a group out there of Christians who have alternate counseling that they provide that talk to young ladies who are in this condition about other options. But am I really going to want to protest Planned Parenthood? And you can fill in any one of another number of things there that you want to. How are we presenting ourselves to the world? Okay, let's look at what Jesus did. John chapter 8. He's being questioned by the Pharisees who are trying to trap him. They bring a woman to him who has been caught in adultery, wanting him to condemn her and to condemn her soul, we think, conjecture. They were trying to trap him in this. John 8, verse 3, the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, placing her in the midst. They said to him, teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What do you say? This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. As they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. Once more he bent and wrote on the ground. I'd love to know what he was writing on the ground there, wouldn't you? When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, women, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go now and sin no more. I suspect that 30 years ago, if it had been me there, I would have said, of course you know you're sinning. Don't you know you're going to condemn your soul to hell by behaving like this? And it would have been a true statement, but Jesus says, I don't condemn you. He didn't condone the action. He said, you've got to change your behavior, but he didn't come across with this lady of, you're going to go to hell. A couple chapters earlier, John chapter 4, he's in a Samaritan town, sitting there by the well looking for a drink. He's tired. Sitting there, verse 5, verse 6, Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said, give me a drink, for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, how is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. The woman said to him, sir, you have nothing to draw water with and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well and drank from it himself as did his sons and his livestock. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty forever. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. Jesus said to her, go, call your husband and come here. The woman answered, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshiped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming. He is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Again, Jesus could have gone and he knew up front that this woman had had five husbands, could have refused to talk to her, could have castigated her for her lifestyle, but he chose to approach her and teach her about the living water rather than castigating her for her lifestyle. Paul, Athens, Mars Hill, Acts chapter 17. Paul goes to this city where it's a polytheistic society. They have multiple gods that they worship. In walking through the sculpture area, recognizes that there is a statue to the unknown god because they were afraid of insulting somebody. So Paul standing there, verse 22, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription to the unknown God. What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, or is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. Talked to them about God. Went out in their midst. Some of them wanted to continue the conversation with Paul. Some of them didn't, but some of them did because he went in saying, let me talk to you about God, about Jesus, not castigating them for how dare they believe in 27,000 other gods out there. And finally, Acts chapter 19. Paul is in Ephesus. He's been there for a while. He's been walking around talking about Jesus and God. Town's in an uproar because of the goddess Artemis was there, also known as Diana. Verse 35, when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. I don't know whether you realize it or not, but under Roman law, part of the way that they expanded their empire and kept peace is they basically allowed whatever people they conquered to keep their deities. And they had a law passed by their Senate that says if anyone blasphemes one of these local deities, it's a capital crime and they could be put to death. So Paul is here in Ephesus where this goddess Artemis had a temple. The people are in an uproar. The town clerk says, you have no cause to go after these men. Meaning, I believe there's no legal thing that you can go after them for because they have not blasphemed your goddess. So, what do I bring from that? Paul was in this city, this polytheistic society again, with a temple that was known for the temple prostitution that went along with the religion that they worshiped, that they followed. And in all of his teachings, had never said anything negative about Artemis. So the conclusion I bring from that is Paul spent his time talking about God and about Jesus. Now, I promise you that I know enough about Joseph Smith, I know enough about Muhammad, that if I wanted to tear those men down and expose them for frauds, I can do so. If I'm talking with a Mormon, if I'm talking with someone from the Nation of Islam, are they going to be wanting to talk to me if I come out and I'm talking about that, about their leaders? Paul didn't talk about Artemis. I'm not going to talk that way about other leaders if I'm talking to that part of that society. Okay, some examples. This is Joe and Pascal. They are dear friends of Leslie and I's from Gainesville, Florida. This is a really good picture of Joe. Normally he has his head shaved and he's an ex-Vietnam vet and he's got tattoos all over his arms. Joe found the family there at Glen Springs because we had a radio show. He was driving around with Pascal one day and said, "Something's going on with my life," and turned onto this radio channel and heard the passage of the day, showed up at our doorsteps. He was converted. Pascal was converted. At least one of their boys was converted. And if you want someone to talk to about the impact of drugs, the impact of alcohol, the impact of that lifestyle, Joe is the person to go talk to. But Joe and Pascal are also examples of what I'm talking about, of going out and seeking people. Just recently, there's a string of emails that Joe was talking about Mike. He found Mike living in a cardboard box at the end of the private road that they live on. Mike was a drug addict and an alcohol abuser, struggling with life. Joe and Pascal went to him, says, "We've got a better something better for you." Got him into drug counseling, got him some clothes, got him a job, allowed the family there at Glen Springs Road to interact with Mike, to try to influence him. And had success for a while, but the world was really too strong for Mike. And after a couple, 3 months of interacting with God's family there in Gainesville, Mike said, "It's not for me." This is the life that Joe and Pascal live over and over and over again. Some of you may recognize this face. This is Phil Robertson, famous of the Duck Dynasty family. Several months ago, he decided to do an interview with GQ. Why he decided to do that, I have no idea. But the public and the media castigated Phil for his position on homosexuality. What a lot of people don't understand is this is what was actually recorded in the article, if they had taken time to read it. I'm going to read this for you. And Phil and his family are members of the West Monroe Church of Christ, who honestly believe some things that I don't, but the message that they have pretty much is consistent with Seekers. He says, "We never, ever judge someone on who's going to heaven or hell. That's the Almighty's job. We just love them, give them the good news about Jesus, whether they're homosexuals, drunks, terrorists. We let God sort them out later. You see what I'm saying?" He does not judge someone's character. He just wants to teach them about Jesus. Go back to Christopher Hitchens for a second. Talk to you about all the bad things that happened. There were actually a group of Christians that very late in his life, before he died, a group of Christians sent him some letters and some cards saying, "We're praying for you. We're praying that you'll get well. We're praying that you'll survive your cancer. We're praying that you will live long enough that you will be able to understand about God and Jesus." And he wrote an article. I tried to find it. I read it several years ago. He wrote an article that basically said he could not believe this group of Christians who would write to him in this way after all the other things that he had happened and all the things that he had written. I'll put to you that this is the group of Christians that I think got it and understood what they were supposed to be representing to those in the world. Okay. Some applications. How are we going to interact with people around us? Are we going to remember the two greatest commandments? Love the God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul. And love your neighbor as yourself. Who's the neighbor? The parable of the Good Samaritan says the neighbor is that person that's struggling out there, who's hurt, who's injured, who has troubles in their lives. We're supposed to treat that person as if he were ourselves. We need to interact with everyone, assuming that they're looking to find God. We don't get to pick and choose who's looking for God, who's looking for Jesus. We need to live our lives and interact with others as if every person we meet is wanting to do that. Does this influence how we deal with them? Certainly should. It means that we need to think about the person that just cut us off on I-45 and I'm driving into work every morning. Need to be thinking about the person that curses us out at work or on the street because we do something they didn't like. Should influence how we interact if you're a student nowadays, how you interact with the students around you, how you interact with the people at work. Bottom line is, do we see sin or do we see sinners? Are we going to deal with the sin or are we going to deal with the sinner? My stories. Last year, went home for the Tennessee-Florida football game. We played well in the first half. Second half wasn't so good. My daughter-in-law had a pain attack. We were sitting in traffic trying to get out away from this game afterwards. And I had an interaction with another driver that wasn't representing that. My brother decided to be my brother and got out and stood in front of this car that was waiting in line to force him to allow us in, which that escalated things. But instead of telling my brother to get back in the car, that things were going to be okay, I allowed it to escalate to the point of where they were throwing stuff at our car. And I ended up getting out of the car and walking back to the driver of the car behind me, basically telling him to stop it or I was going to call the police, because I wasn't going to put up with that kind of behavior. I could have done a lot of things. I could have, again, told Patrick to get back in the car. It never would have escalated. I could have walked back and said, no, my brother was just trying to do this. I apologize for him, and I'm really sorry for this escalating the way that it is. And just, please forgive me for what we've done. But we didn't do any of that. Several weeks ago at work, I'm lead engineer for one of the groups at work. And one of the project managers did something that they should not have done. They changed my work product. I think I'm pretty good at what I do. And I was not real happy that he changed my work product. And I wrote an email to him saying, how dare you do that? And I'd already started thinking about this sermon, so I immediately tore up that email. And I had to go back and rewrite it because in thinking about how I'm interacting with him, I need to approach him in a way that if he showed up at the building here tomorrow, he wouldn't turn around and walk out because he saw me. And I could still do my job, but I do my job differently if I am thinking about how Jesus would respond, and if I think about how I'm going to respond to keep from turning this person away. I ended up sending an email basically saying, John, it says, we talked about this. I thought we had it settled. Would you please come talk to me next time before you decide to change stuff? Which is a whole different tenor than, how dare you change what I wrote? Don't you think you don't have any authority to do so? I'm the one that's in charge here. I'm the one that's responsible for this. How dare you change it? Two different concepts and approaches on how we do things. And I consciously thought about that as I rewrote the email. I don't know what your stories are. Y'all, I'm sure there's many of you would have stories along this line. My last story is my dad. My dad was not a member of the church. Lived with my mother for 54 years. I would put my mother up there as the biblical example of a godly woman. Far as I know, he never stepped foot in the church building after they were married. When they went on vacation, my mom would be visiting going to church. He would sit out in the car rather than go inside the church building. When asked about it, one of the things that he said was, I work with two guys you go to church with. I want to be nothing like them. They were living the life in the pew, but they weren't living the life in their work. They weren't representing Jesus when they were at work. He never said what they did. I never asked. But it was enough for me to know that those two men, with the way they behaved at work, were going to be called to task by God on the day of eternity for what they were doing and influencing those around them. So where do we go from here? If you are a follower of Christ, every interaction that you have with people represent who you are. Last month I did the Sunday night singing. I didn't do a very good job of making my talk. Every decision we make exposes to other people what our priorities are. Every word you say, every action you do, tells others around you who you are. If you're in school and you cheat on a test, if you're at work and you engage in unethical behavior, if you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off and you give them the middle finger, you're exposing who you are. Everything we do needs to point people to Christ. If you're not a member of God's kingdom, and you have been influenced by someone who has had this kind of behavior, you need to walk away from it. You need to forget it. You need to recognize that God is there, that Jesus is there. Jesus is our Savior, that we have the hope of eternal life in heaven after our death, regardless of how the people around us behave. If you're a seeker, it doesn't matter what you've done in your life up to now. Paul called himself the chiefest of all sinners. He had gone and, if not murdered Christians, at least arrested them for being Christians in his life. 1 Corinthians 6, when we opened up with, don't you know that this whole list of people will not inherit the kingdom of God? And such were some of you. The Christians in the first century weren't raised in the church. The Gentiles weren't raised in the church. They had things that they had done in their lives. But they recognized that Jesus was their Savior, that they had to change their lives, they had to become what God wanted them to be. Finally, are you going to walk in darkness? Or are you going to walk in the light? Saul, king of Israel, committed sins that were in reality a lot less bad than what David did. but his heart changed, didn't seek God. David, having committed murder and adultery, recognized what had happened in his life and turned back to God when he could have gone the other direction. And he's listed as being a man of God's own heart. If you're seeking something in your life, I want to talk to you about Jesus. There's many, many people here that want to talk to you about Jesus. What he can do for you. People here in this family who will help you with the things that you're struggling with. Even if you're a member of the church and you have struggles, there are people here who will help you with those struggles. The reason that God has put us together as a spiritual family so that we'll have people to lean on. So, if you're seeking, find someone to talk to you about Jesus. If you're struggling with your life, talk to one of the elders. Talk to somebody here. They can help you get over those hurdles in your life. The bottom line is, I want to go to heaven. I hope you want to go to heaven. I hope everyone wants to go to heaven. And we cannot be a barrier to people who want to go to heaven. And if we don't behave as God wants us to in every facet of our life, we're going to be that barrier. So, if you're subject, you have an invitation song picked out, you have an opportunity to come to God, come to Jesus, get your life straight, let us help if we can. I'll stand and sing.